Welcome to the Diplomacist Podcast, intimate discussions to get behind the headlines.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second podcast on East Asian foreign politics. This time, we'll focus on Japanese security and Japanese relations to the world. We have here Professor Katzenstein, an expert on Japanese security. So let's get started. So we'll have two broad categories of questions to ask. The first questions pertain to U.S.-Japanese relations, followed by Japan and Asia. So the first question is about U.S.-Japanese relations. In your publication in 2007, you stressed the role of Japan as a crucial supporter state in the wider American imperium. And yet, Robert Dervis stressed in 2002 that, of all the relationship within the security community, quote, the U.S.-Japanese relationship is most strained, quote, end quote. We see two contradictory propositions here. While you claim Japan has remained a steadfast U.S. ally, Dervis believes relations have deteriorated between the two nations. How would you describe the current U.S.-Japanese relationship in the year 2015?
So I think the relationships are even stronger than they were in 2002, and I don't understand what my good friend Bob Dervis was referring to when he said that it was very strained. It wasn't, in my opinion. And it has been, if there was a strain, it was in the early 1970s, when the reorientation of U.S. diplomacy towards China and the soybean embargo were imposed. That was a real strain, I think, for Japan, but not in the last 40 years. And with the rise of China and the disorientation that's caused in Japan, if anything, the alliances tightened further, both from the Japanese perspective and from the American perspective. That is the pivot to Asia, you know, the crucial country in East Asia for the United States is Japan. So I really see no great problems on the horizon unless something dramatic in East Asia shocks Japan and the U.S. doesn't do enough to reassure Japan. That could be, you know, aggression from North Korea or some accidental war breaking out in South China Sea or something, right? Short of that, I think that relationship is very solid.
So during the Cold War, it was the common threat posed by Russia that united the two. Nowadays, that the common threat still exists now in the form of China?
Well, I think that's a Japanese formulation of it. I think a lot of Japanese, not all, a lot of Japanese see China rising as a potential threat, not necessarily a threat, but a potential threat, as a lot of Americans do. But a lot of Japanese and a lot of Americans see it as a great opportunity. So, you know, Japan has always regarded, you know, China with ambivalence. And certainly during the Cold War, the Japanese left was much more favorably inclined to China than was the American left. So there's a lot of goodwill in Japan towards China. But it is true that Japan has lost its role, its traditional role of 150 years of being the interpreter of Asia to the West. And that's deeply disorienting. And that's a psychological disorientation, right? So by now, people look to China. They don't look to Japan. And you can see it here on the Cornell campus. You see it in the public media, right? You don't see it in American diplomacy. American diplomacy is very tuned to the power and importance of Japan.
Interesting. Very interesting. So you're saying that the American diplomacy will, at least at this current point, will continue to regard Japan as the primary interpreter of East Asia, while other people may start to interpret China.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the United States being the interpreter of East Asia to the West or the rest of the world is very important in the self-perception of the Japanese. It isn't very important to the Americans.
Ah, I see.
Right. So the psychological disorientation is on the Japanese side. The Americans look at Japan, its economic potential, its stable democracy, its role as a trusted long-time ally, and saying that's an important anchor for us as we are pivoting towards Asia.
Interesting. There's definitely been a change in the Japanese government's relations to the world in that Recently, the Japanese government passed a legislation that permits the deployment of Japanese military personnel on foreign soil as part of any UN-sanctioned intervention. The basic agreement between the U.S. and Japan since the end of World War II was that U.S. provides security for Japan, while Japan refrains from using her troop. To what extent does this legislation jeopardize this agreement? Are the Americans in favor or against this reorientation?
I think the Americans have asked for this for the last 25 years, so they're very much in agreement, and they don't really think about the Japanese boots on the ground. They think about combat support of the Japanese Navy or the American Navy in case there's trouble in the South China Sea. So I think that's really, it's about naval cooperation. So this was something which the Americans have asked for ever since 1990. Quietly, right?
Yes.
And Abe has finally said, I think he's always wanted this, and he said my approval ratings are high enough, and the disappearance of all domestic opposition but it gives me a lot of license to do this. And he's paid a very heavy price for this, so his approval rating is way down. Abenomics is not working. Japan has just entered a recession again with 2 quarters of negative growth. So this may not work out too well for Mr. Abe. Right? But it is something he's deeply committed to and deeply believes in. So I think it really, when you looked at his election campaign, he was very authentic on these types of issues. He wasn't very authentic on many other issues. Right?
So, definitely. Yeah, back in the election in last November, he did say that if the LDP wins this election, we will try to pass this legislation. So indeed, he was being very authentic and presenting to the Japanese people his will of trying to permit the deployment of Japanese personnel and the Japanese Navy, as you said. You said that the Americans were looking for this for the last 25 years. And you stressed that this reorientation happened in 1990. Why did this reorientation happen?
Because with the end of the Cold War, the Americans said, you Japanese should be getting ready for the 21st century, and you're so preoccupied with the legacy of World War II that will constrain, you know, the burden you will have to carry. So I think this is not going to change. And ISIS and the effects, you know, in Paris right now and future bombings. If you had a mass bombing in Japan, that might be different. Short of that, I think, you know, they will be symbolically part of a counter coalition. They may provide some resources, but they'll try to stay away from it as far as possible.
Definitely, it doesn't, and neither does ISIS really have a lot of incentive to go against Japan.
Right.
It's not really, there's plenty of other targets. So do the Americans expect any more from Japan in terms of security affairs?
I don't think so. I mean, on counterterrorism, I don't think so.
On counterterrorism, not necessarily, yeah. So you stressed that how about in terms of U.S. bases in Japanese soils, though? There's always been the contention over U.S. bases on Japanese soil, but the issue has really came into the mainstream politics of Japan in recent years. U.S. bases were on Japanese soils for the last 70 years. Why are they suddenly becoming a main issue?
Well, not suddenly. I think the opposition movement in Okinawa dates back to the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know, it has been very intense for the last 20-25 years. And don't forget, Okinawa is basically the Hawaii of China.
Yeah.
So this is cutting deeply into potential business. And Okinawans are an ethnic minority, and they always have felt that they were bossed around by the Japanese, the central government, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a recent issue, and the Americans need the base, they insist on that. The Japanese government realizes they can't now withdraw their support, right?
Yeah.
The left-wing government might have done this, but Abe can't, right? So I think it's going to play itself out the way it has over the last 25 years, with probably the base not being moved for another 10 or 15 years. I think it's a long, drawn-out fencing match.
Yeah. I mean, Okinawa has been in American hands until 70s or the 80s.
72.
And one of the recent discoveries made was that there were American nukes stationed in Okinawa, and that was part of the deal to exchange those sort of thing, to receive Okinawa back into Japanese soil. The term was that the Japanese Japanese stationed nukes in Okinawa.
Well, I mean, the U.S. has never denied or affirmed the stationing of nuclear weapons any place. It's not part of American policy. But it's been public knowledge,
yes,
for at least 15 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether the Japanese press is playing it up again, but it's public knowledge. Right?
Mm.
So I don't. In any case, I don't think there's a sudden concern of the Japanese with Okinawa.
Mm.
I think there's been long-term political conflict. The Japanese government is in line with moving the base with the Americans. The local population doesn't want to do this, and it's a standoff, and it's likely to continue to be a standoff.
Yes. Yeah, definitely Okinawans have been constantly a mitigated minority, especially because the Okinawans were actually the only Japanese soil to actually see real fighting during 1945.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it was a horrible battle.
It is very understandable how the Okinawans are very ambivalent towards Americans, especially because pretty much they were used as a sacrifice to preserve the Japanese mainland for a while. Talking about Okinawan bases, though, in 2001, you stressed that the United States will increasingly use U.S. bases on Japanese soil for global power projection beyond East Asia. We saw examples of this during Vietnam War or involvement in some parts of Asia in the 70s and the 80s on the part of Americans, where American GIs were treated in Okinawa and in Japanese hospitals. You went as far to say that the Okinawan bases may become critical supply areas for U.S. operations as far as that in the Middle East. To what extent has your prophecy come true?
Well, you know, the Middle East from the perspective of East Asia is called West Asia.
Mm.
I mean, so China talks about the Middle East in terms of West Asia. So Middle East is not quite as far away. It's sort of a nice ride across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And if you think logistically, you know, Guam, Okinawa, they're part of the basing strategy of U.S. Navy and Air Force. So that means that the Middle East is part of a basing strategy. But what has changed is that with the announced pivot towards Asia, Okinawa, of course, its strategic importance has increased further for East Asia, for the South China Sea. Right? So I think that its regional importance has increased, and its global importance has probably been left unaffected, but I think now Okinawa is really part of a containment strategy of China and the South China Sea, and the Japanese Navy and American Navy cooperate on this.
Yeah. The Japanese recently, especially in recent years, have been feeling a bit neglected by the American authorities, especially since the coming of Obama. Japan and America had a very tight relationship during the Bush administration, but many Japanese people, at least, fear that the Americans are shifting away towards China in the recent years, especially under the Obama administration. Is this fear only perceived, or is there a genuine threat of?
Well, I think it's largely due to the psychological insecurity in Japan about what its role is in international relations.
Mm.
As I said before, for 150 years, Japan had a particular role. It was interpreting Asia to the West,
yeah,
and vice versa. And that's gone. And so, cut off from its psychological moorings, Japan is sort of feeling very insecure and fragile. But in terms of diplomacy and alliance politics, there's really no objective basis for that.
Mm.
It's true America is more interested and engaged with China,
mm,
but that doesn't counteract the importance of the US-Japan security treaty, which is the equivalent of NATO and East Asia.
Yeah.
It's that important.
I see.
So.
Yeah, the Japanese identity is definitely in a state of crisis. Do you think what would be a new identity that perhaps the Japanese people can adopt in the newer, in the current diplomatic situation in Asia?
I don't know whether it's in crisis or in flux, you know, but I think the Japanese leadership has shown to be ineffective of developing a positive vision for Japan. That's probably its greatest failing over the last 25 years, ever since 1990.
Yeah.
It's forever trying to crisis manage, but no politician or no party has in fact said, we are a model of a different kind. Let's say a model of a greening, aging society. And don't forget, we are the society which grew fast in per capita terms than the United States between 2000 and 2010. Nobody in Japan says that.
Yeah.
It is fact. It is a fact. Because if you have a shrinking population, per capita growth will increase much more readily. So the greatest political failing is not on part of the Japanese, it's on part of the Japanese political leadership, which has not been able to offer a new perspective on politics to the Japanese. In the 1980s it was, we will conquer world markets. Right. But nothing has come. And so everybody's waiting. And unless that happens, I think the sense of insecurity will persist.
I see. So you find the flux in Japanese identity, the origin of flux in identity comes from Japanese domestic politics.
Yeah, and the ineffectiveness of the leadership to define a political program. And now what you see is the political program they have defined or can fall back on is traditional Japanese nationalism.
Yeah.
It's not a particularly attractive one as far as I'm concerned. And many in Japan are not moved by that vision.
Yeah.
But a substantial number of Japanese are moved by it, you know. So but there's no other game in town, no other counter vision of what Japan could become.
Yeah.
All societies are aging. The most rapidly aging society in the world is China, it's not Japan. Japan could say, we've been aging for 30 years, we have thought more about it, we have experimented more with it, we were with the world leading society or dealing with the problem of aging in a civilized, humane way.
Mm.
Japan is a very civilized, humane society. But nobody's saying that.
Yeah.
Right? So.
There's definitely been different solutions, but no one's really been offering the solutions. Mm. For a very brief period of time, the Democratic Party took power.
Oh. I mean, I have some other students coming.
Okay. What time is it right now?
It's 4:20.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to Japan and Asia, I guess. Then. So recently, the Japanese agreed to participate in a trilateral summit with Korea and China. The decade-long tension between Japan and mainland Asia needs not be mentioned. Do you believe the summit is a genuine gesture towards peace in Asia, or is it just part of a larger peace offensive on both sides?
I think it's both. I think the various conflicts in East Asia serve each of the countries for domestic purposes. And they're masterfully dialing them up and dialing them down depending on their domestic political needs. And when everybody dials them up, it looks very threatening. And when everybody dials them down, everything is quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I wouldn't, I take this with a grain of salt, these conflicts. I think they serve domestic political purposes. The awareness of the advantages of regional cooperation in all three countries are very high. And so when you have these domestic pressures interfering with an awareness of international benefits from whether it's the summit or any number of regional initiatives, right? You probably say that there are two political logics at play at the same time.
Mm.
Right? So you mentioned here before the Infrastructure Investment Bank, right?
Yes.
So this is a China initiative. The Americans don't like it. And so the Japanese stayed out, in evidence for the close alliance. But the Europeans are joining.
Yes.
So by inference, does that mean that the Europeans are less good allies than Japan? Not so sure about that.
Yeah.
But I think I would be stunned if Japan wasn't a member of this bank within 5 years.
Hmm.
And also the United States.
Interesting.
Okay. So I think they are competing logics, and the domestic fires, you know, the domestic politics of winning elections and shoring up your political base is often well served by picking a fight with somebody abroad.
Hmm. So this summit, it's a policy of domestic politics.
Well, no, the summit I think reflects the advantages of regional cooperation, and it's a symbolic, it's a symbol, right? But there are many cooperative initiatives in East Asia. They have a different logic from the ones in Europe, but they're very important.
Yeah.
Right? So,
despite all the potential for cooperation, there has been definitely not a competition, especially regarding territorial disputes between Japan and Asia. It seems like there has been a sudden proliferation of border problems over small islands between Japan and Asia, and in between Asian countries too. Are the islands and its surrounding waters contested because of its economic importance, or does the dispute arise from some constructed importance attached to these islands, or are there other reasons these islands are important?
So Ishihara, when he outwitted the left-wing government in Japan,
yeah,
did it because he is a nationalist.
Yes.
Right? And the Japanese government was particularly inept in buying the islands and thereby inserting itself into this conflict directly. It struck me as a particularly inconsidered, even dumb action. It was very predictable what was going to happen.
Mm.
Right? So it was, the issue was pushed by the Japanese right and confounded by a very big error by the Japanese government.
Mm.
So that's the first thing. Then I don't think that the primary thing is economics. The primary thing is law.
I see.
International law. That Japan has claimed, you know, since 1945, a very large part of the Pacific Ocean. And under customary law, if you claim it and nobody objects, after a while, it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese have legitimate claims and hadn't asserted them. And then they woke up and said, here's the Japanese right and the Japanese government. And they're actually now consolidating what's customary law into public international law. We are not going to accept that.
Mm.
Right. So I don't regard the Chinese as the initiators, I regard the Japanese as the initiators.
I see.
And yes, there are economic resources there, which are attractive and important, but I think they're not as important as the symbolism of the right and the power of customary law. And Japan, you know, is only one of many countries which have conflicts with China over
yeah.
these islands. You know? So this is not a Chinese-Japanese problem. It is a Chinese-everybody's problem.
Yes. Interesting. Do you think that there could be an accidental war over these islands?
Yes. I do think that the ratcheting up of the, you know, it used to be fishing boats. Then it was Coast Guard boats. Then it was Coast Guard boats with water cannons. And if you've seen some of the pictures, these Coast Guard boats often are within 100 yards of each other.
Yeah.
They are now armed. They used to be not armed. All of this escalated in 2013, 2014. And yes, it could. Accidents can very easily happen when so many boats are so close together. Could it result in a big shooting war? I doubt it. Could it result in accidental war of a small kind, which sort of goes on, you know, two or three boats sunk? Yes, that could happen. Yeah.
Where would Americans stand if such war happened?
They would be very uncomfortable. The first thing they would say, stop shooting. Okay. If you know, now have the sense that there's a full-time mobilization of the Chinese and Japanese army, and navy, the Americans would have to come in. But it's a very low probability event. But
yeah.
I regard an accidental war as entirely possible.
Mm.
When you have that many naval forces on such a small area, you know, with hostile intention and bluffing and these water cannons, you know, things can go wrong.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely. Well, on that grim note, we end the second of our podcasts on East Asian relations. Thank you very much, Professor Katzenstein.
You're most welcome.
We appreciate your input. It was a very interesting experience.